Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Graylin Hagler, senior pastor of Washington, D.C.'s Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, who examines the links between the tragic murder of nine people at a Charleston, South Carolina church and the racist dog whistle rhetoric identified with the GOP's conservative political agenda. Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center, who describes the current legal battle underway in Texas to prevent the closure of most of that state's abortion clinics. And Jim Dean of the group Democracy for America, who discusses the fundamental dangers for democracy that he sees in the current push for free trade legislation and the threat he's leveled at Democratic legislators who vote for its passage. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir evaded an arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court, or ICC, in mid-June when he boarded a private plane in South Africa bound for Sudan before a judge ordered him arrested. While Bashir was attending the recent two-day African Union summit hosted by South Africa, the ICC issued two arrest warrants against the Sudanese leader for his complicity in atrocities committed in Darfur a decade ago, where over 300,000 people were killed. Bashir has condemned the ICC as illegitimate and has been able to travel freely across the African continent without fear of arrest. South African High Court Judge Dunstan Malombo criticized the government of President Jacob Zuma for not detaining and arresting Bashir as inconsistent with the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. The ruling African National Congress Party has denounced the ICC for persecuting African leaders. But South Africa is not alone in that many key world powers, including the United States, Russia, and China, have undermined the work of the ICC by refusing to join and officially refusing to submit to its authority. Thousands of Haitian nationals living in the neighboring Dominican Republic waited in long lines to register as permanent residents or face the threat of deportation. The status of Haitian migrants and those born in the Dominican Republic to Haitian parents has been in dispute ever since a 2013 court decision that stripped citizen rights from the children of Haitian immigrants. For decades, poor Haitians have moved to the Dominican Republic seeking work cutting sugarcane and as domestic workers. The Dominican government set a mid-June deadline for migrants and other non-citizens to establish their identity and present proof that they lived in the country prior to October 2011 or face deportation. Few of the 500,000 Haitian nationals in the country have passports or official identity cards. Without ID cards, Haitians and their children fear mass deportation back to a desperately poor nation where few have family ties. The Dominican government has hired over 2,000 new police and security officers to enforce the new citizenship law, and there are reports that Haitian immigrants are being picked up and secretly deported. According to the Guardian newspaper, in 2015, 40,000 people have already been deported back to Haiti. Anti-Keystone tar sands pipeline activist Bradley Stute was placed on a U.S. government watch list for domestic airline flights by the FBI during the agency's campaign targeting so-called environmental extremists. Stute discovered he was on the watch list, called Secondary Security Screening Selection, when he flew to Texas to visit a friend last December and was subjected to invasive airport security measures. The Guardian newspaper reported that the FBI investigation into Keystone activists was officially closed in June 2014. However, internal FBI documents reveal the investigation was opened without the approval of the chief legal counsel at the FBI's Houston office, leading to an FBI internal report finding substantial noncompliance with U.S. Department of Justice rules. In spite of this, Stute and other Keystone activists continue to be monitored by law enforcement. The activists are cited in the FBI's Guardian Threat Tracking System, a database of suspicious activity reports and counterterrorism threat assessments that can be searched by all FBI employees. In addition, published documents state that the FBI's Houston office pledged to share pertinent intelligence of potential threats with TransCanada, the giant Canadian oil company pushing to build the controversial Keystone Tar Sands oil pipeline from Alberta to Texas. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The cold-blooded murder of eight black parishioners and their pastor by an avowed white supremacist at Charleston, South Carolina's historic Emmanuel AME Church on June 17th once again exposed the deep racial divisions in the U.S. While the massacre was greeted by calls for unity and healing, a debate quickly ensued about the Confederate flag flying in a place of honor at the state capitol in Columbia. Before committing the murders, the accused killer, 21-year-old Dylan Roof, had posted photos of himself waving a Confederate flag on a website that also featured his racist manifesto titled The Last Rhodesian. While many conservative Republican politicians in South Carolina, as well as GOP presidential candidates, had previously supported Southern states' display of the Confederate flag, stating it represented heritage, not hate, the Charleston massacre has changed the contours of the debate. In a June 22nd press conference, South Carolina's Republican Governor Nikki Haley shifted her position on the issue, urging the state legislature to vote for removal of the flag from the Capitol grounds. But many observers maintained that more subtle forms of racism and white supremacist ideology continue to flourish among many conservative activists. They point to the Republican Party's national push to curtail voting rights of African Americans and other minorities, as well as concerted attacks on social safety net programs that benefit poor blacks and Latinos. Your reporter spoke with Reverend Graylin Hagler, senior pastor of the Plymouth Congregational Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. Here he discusses the links between the tragic murder of nine in Charleston and the racist dog whistle rhetoric that has become identified with the GOP's conservative political agenda.
Well, in general, we have avoided historically the issues of race and racism. We have chosen to try to look at it in terms of isolated incidents and not so much as a power paradigm, that keeps people oppressed, that keeps people in second and third class status, that has continued to be the hallmark of the structure of this country. The fact is that you can have a so-called intellectual argument on over whether the Confederate flag flying on the Capitol grounds of the South Carolina Capitol, whether that's a thing of honor or symbol of degradation and oppression. We have moved things into sort of their intellectual qualities, and that way we always deny racism. Yeah, I think the country, in a sense, deluded itself when we elected a black president, thinking that we had clearly moved into a post-racial era. And as a consequence of electing a black president, I think that we have seen the ugly head of racism reemerge in a very virulent fashion, a very overt fashion, even down to the point that we dress up our racist attacks right now, and we call it conservatism. But if you look at sort of the conservative arguments that take place in this country, it's always against immigrants, it's against people of color, it's against black folks, it's against women. It is very xenophobic in its perspective and its outlook. And so, in a sense, it becomes the old racist paradigms of the past that are just dressed up contemporarily and put in a tuxedo. It may sound a little bit different. It may not sound as raw, but it's still as dangerous as it was in the past.
Reverend Hagler, explain to our audience, if you would, your views on how the dog whistle racism we see in U.S. politics, which unfortunately has become so commonplace, it's accepted by and large, and the kind of violence we've seen in Charleston and other places around the country where right-wing extremist groups crop up and attack minority groups, while we have Republican and conservative legislators in Congress voting in voter suppression laws and cutting programs for the poor.
Well, I mean, it's the old stuff that took place at the end of the Civil War during the Reconstruction era. The Reconstruction era where we basically militarily enforced one person, one vote. It brought a number of black folks to office in terms of Congress and judges and locally in terms of city councilors. And then basically the white supremacists engaged in a war of terror and terrorism and threatened anybody who would turn out to the polls. And we ended up, therefore, restricting people from voting. And that basically lasted up until basically the Voting Rights Act. And here we go right now with an attempt to turn back the clock previous to the Voting Rights Act. So we engage in the same type of tactics, the same type of tactics of terror, the same type of tactics of basically legislating discrimination and oppression. And we end up also with a court that basically dismantles affirmative action, dismantles protection of voting rights. And so we end up with a country that really reinforces and affirms a white supremacist paradigm. And that's what we're called to dismantle. We have to dismantle that with all of our efforts, with all of our might. We have to engage in dismantling the paradigms that exist that keep people oppressed.
Reverend Hagler, I wondered if you'd address or assess the wider threat of right-wing and white supremacist groups that, according to a recent study, are the leading source of ideological violence in America, far surpassing the threat of Islamic extremist individuals or groups.
Well, you had an interesting case not too long ago that took place in Texas, where we ended up and the media turned and they said that that radical Islamists came and tried to attack an event that was set up to basically draw cartoons, demeaning cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. I think you remember that. And very seldom did the media talk about that group that was sponsoring the event was on the Southern Poverty Law Center's list of hate groups. So basically the media bought into that it was a First Amendment event, when in fact it was really a racist event in order to create some type of provocation. And that's what I'm getting at, is that we refuse to confront racism head on, and we refuse to confront the hate groups head on. Like we find out that many of the Republican candidates received money from one of the racist leaders in the country, and Cruz said that he was going to send back the money after it was exposed. But that's been a part of the historical value of racism, and that we had white citizen councils at one time that basically you had to go and you had to genuflect before in order to get elected, and you had at one point in the 20s you had to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan in order to get elected, particularly in the South. And that's a part of the historical fabric of this nation. And it's really a something that continues to be there as a cancer, and we have to find ways to cut it out, but the only way you can cut it out is confront it.
That was Reverend Graylin Hagler, senior pastor of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. For more perspectives on the murders in Charleston and racism in America, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Conservative legislatures and governors in many states across the U.S. have succeeded at whittling away at abortion rights over the past several years. This has occurred as the anti-choice movement has migrated from street protests and from sometimes violent assaults on abortion clinics and staff to pushing for suffocating state regulations. Texas is a prime example. 2 years ago, State Senator Wendy Davis gained national prominence with a filibuster and an unsuccessful attempt to stop passage of anti-choice legislation. However, when the measure passed, women's health providers in Texas filed appeals. In mid-June, the Federal Appeals Court for the Fifth Circuit upheld the law, and now advocates are asking the U.S. Supreme Court for an emergency ruling that would keep abortion clinics open, pending a final ruling if the court chooses to hear the case. In 2012, Texas had 41 abortion clinics serving most of the state. Now Texas has only 19 operating clinics, and that number would be reduced to 9 if the legislation takes effect. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Health and Reproductive Rights at the National Women's Law Center. Here she describes the current state of abortion rights in Texas, and another case in Iowa where there was an attempt to prevent the use of telemedicine in which doctors can prescribe abortion pills via video link, a practice that Texas has outlawed.
So we just have the latest decisions from the court in Texas, who essentially said that this law can go into effect, that all but 9 clinics in the state of Texas can be forced to shut their doors, and women are going to be left without access to abortion. And the court didn't care that that meant that some women would have to travel more than 1,000 miles round trip to get an abortion. The court said they don't care if that means women have to go to another state, to New Mexico, to get an abortion. They are going to let this law go into effect. And so the healthcare providers have asked the Supreme Court to step in and block this law so that the clinics aren't forced to shut down and women aren't left without access to abortion.
Can you just explain a little more what these two issues are that the court ruled on?
There are a couple of provisions here that are being fought over. One is whether clinics have to come up to the standards of ambulatory surgical centers. It's a completely unnecessary requirement, and it's totally burdensome for clinics. They can't come into compliance. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it just means that they have to shut their doors. So that's one requirement. And then the other requirement is whether doctors have to have admitting privileges at a local hospital, which, again, is completely unnecessary. And doctors aren't able to get admitting privileges at hospitals. So it's another way to shut down these clinics. And these requirements are a sham. They're advancing these kinds of restrictions, saying that they're needed for women's health. But the intent is to shut down clinics. And it's politicians, not doctors, who are pushing these restrictions. And that's why provider groups like the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Medical Association oppose these kinds of restrictions, because they're not about patient safety. They're about shutting down clinics and taking abortion away from women.
And it's not because these are bad doctors that they can't get admitting privileges at local hospitals, right? But more because abortion is usually a safe procedure and very few women need hospitalization. And if a doctor doesn't admit a lot of patients, then he or she is unlikely to get those privileges. And of course, Catholic hospitals would never grant privileges to a doctor doing abortions.
Right. So hospitals have all kinds of quotas to give somebody admitting privileges. And it's based on things like how many patients you admit. And abortion is a very safe procedure. So they're not in the practice of admitting patients when you provide abortions, because it's so safe and women aren't needing to go to the hospital.
And you're saying it's currently being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes. So the court in Texas just said that they would not block this law, that they want it to go into effect. And if it is going into effect on July 1st, that's going to shut every clinic but 9 in the entire state of Texas. The second largest state in the country would only have 9 abortion clinics. And so the women's health care providers have filed a petition for emergency action for the Supreme Court, basically asking the court to block this law so that the clinics don't have to shut down. The law would be blocked while the providers then ask the Supreme Court to review the case more fully. But in the meantime, what they want to do is block it so that women don't lose access to abortion right away. Texas isn't the only state that where abortion restrictions are pending before the court. So there is a court case from Mississippi right now that's also pending with the Supreme Court and might be worth talking about. So it's not just happening in Texas. So in Mississippi, politicians are trying to shut down the last clinic in the entire state of Mississippi, which would leave women in the state with no ability to get an abortion in the entire state, and they would have to cross state lines. And so the Supreme Court has been asked to review that case. And both of the cases are coming from the same federal court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. So they decided in Mississippi that Mississippi couldn't push its responsibilities onto its neighboring states. But in Texas, they said it was okay to do that. So both of these decisions are pending with the Supreme Court right now.
Well, Gretchen Borschelt, on a better note, the Iowa State Supreme Court just upheld the right of doctors to prescribe abortion pills via video conference. That's encouraging.
Many states are doing this. It's the use of telemedicine to provide all kinds of health care. And abortion is one area that telemedicine has been moving into to try and help women who live in rural areas or who aren't able to get to a provider very easily to be able to get an abortion safe and effectively using telemedicine. And so, not surprisingly, politicians have gone after telemedicine for abortion in another attempt to make it more difficult for women to access abortion. And what happened in Iowa is that the Iowa Board of Medicine passed regulations that effectively meant that the providers couldn't use telemedicine for abortion anymore. And so again, for women in Iowa, many of whom are rural or low income or unable to travel to a provider as many times as they need to because of other restrictions that exist in that state, it meant that they wouldn't be able to get access to an abortion at all. And so the Iowa Supreme Court just rejected all of the state's arguments for promoting these regulations and saying that it would mean that women would lose access to abortion.
That was Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Health and Reproductive Rights at the National Women's Law Center. Find links to groups engaged in the fight to maintain reproductive rights in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a June 12th vote derailing crucial fast-track trade legislation in the House of Representatives, President Obama, backed by a coalition of Republicans and a handful of Democrats, recovered momentum by winning a second House vote and appear poised to win approval in the U.S. Senate. The passage of fast-track, or trade promotion authority, is a necessary prerequisite for later ratification of the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, or TPP, that would set trade rules between the U.S. and 11 other nations. A recent public opinion poll conducted by CBS and the New York Times found that Americans surveyed opposed congressional adoption of Fast Track by a 55-42% margin. With final Senate passage of Fast Track expected on June 24th, opponents of the measure, made up of a national coalition of labor, environmental, and consumer groups, have vowed to continue the fight against the Trans-Pacific Partnership and pledged to punish those Democratic legislators who support President Obama's free trade agenda. Jim Dean, chair of the group Democracy for America, warned, quote, "Democrats who allowed the passage of fast-track authority for the job-killing TPP should know that we will not lift a finger or raise a penny to protect you when you're attacked in 2016. We will encourage our progressive allies to join us in leaving you to rot, and we will actively search for opportunities to primary you with a real Democrat," end quote. Your reporter spoke with Jim Dean, who discusses the fundamental danger for democracy that he sees in the push for free trade legislation and the threat he's leveled at Democratic legislators who vote for its passage.
If the Senate approved this, we are giving this president and any president in the next 5 years authority to negotiate this treaty and put it before Congress with an up or down vote with no amendments. That means no ability for any of us to do something about the fact that corporations can sue local governments if local governments pass legislation to protect their consumers and workers. They will actually not be able to put amendments into the bill to do something about currency manipulation that so many of these so-called trading partners engage in. They will especially not be able to put any amendments into these bills to do something about the slave labor conditions that so many of these so-called trading partners are using right now. The solution is to put a stop to this right now and really do something about the economic inequality issues and particularly the corporate power that's involved with this and giving the corporations the right to go outside of our judicial system to get their way.
Jim, I wondered if you talk about the threat you personally leveled at congressional Democrats pledging to encourage progressive candidates to challenge those Democrats who vote for free trade legislation.
Absolutely. You know, this is the only language that incumbents understand, is the language of the threat to their incumbency. And when you have a situation like this, the Iraq War would be a similar example. These are deal breakers. And the elites in Washington, in the halls of Congress, have somehow are under the impression that if they just go ahead and do this, we're all going to forget about it. And then when they need our help down the road to run for re-election, you know, in a year and a half or so, we're going to be there for them. And we really needed to make it crystal clear that we're not going to be there for them. And not only are we not going to be there for them, but we are looking for credible challengers to primary some of these folks. We're not necessarily assuming that there are going to be those challengers, but we're certainly going to be looking for those opportunities to primary the House, to 28 House members who are Democrats, who voted in favor of Fast Track and voted for all three of these package items to get that through. We're going to be looking to primary them, and we're going to be looking certainly to primary even some of these senators, Democratic senators like Ron Wyden and others, who are voting for this bill. And we're certainly hoping that the ones that are on the fence right now that I just talked about are going to get the message and vote with the people rather than vote with the corporate lobbyists.
Jim, just one final question here, maybe one of the most important questions. Explain what you believe is at stake with these upcoming votes on Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. What, at bottom line, do you think will happen to this country in terms of jobs and the economy if these pieces of legislation, these trade deals that President Obama and many Republicans support, goes forward?
Well, Scott, what is at stake is whether the people are going to be in charge of this country in a democracy or whether corporations are going to be in charge of this country's economic policy and political process. And we need to send a message that the people are in charge. If this agreement goes through, the first biggest thing you're going to notice is that when a state passes, say, raising the minimum wage, we are going to be open to actually being sued under these secret tribunals, as already exist in NAFTA, for doing that. Egypt is now being sued by several corporations for raising its minimum wage. If we pass legislation that are anti-smoking programs, as has happened in the European Union, we are opening up ourselves right now to being sued by corporations because it impugns upon their profits. And in fact, Big Tobacco is suing the European Union right now. And even though the United States governments have not lost any suits yet, the fact is that the taxpayers are spending millions of dollars trying to defend themselves against corporations who have been given an extra avenue in order to pursue their own profit motive without any regard to consumer protections, labor protections, or environmental protections. So that's one big thing that's at stake right now. The second big thing is that we are looking at the lowering of our wages. Americans have not gotten a raise for decades, at least 99% of them right now. This agreement is going to open up more competition and drive down wages in this country. And that is a huge problem. So there's a lot there, but the biggest one is corporate power. This really does a number on the American consumer and the American worker. And if we can defeat it, conversely, it is a tremendous opportunity to send a message that this is a serious problem, that we know it, and we expect our Congress to do a lot better job of taking care of the needs of this country rather than engaging in something that gives big corporations more power over our lives.
That was Jim Dean, chair of the group Democracy for America. For more news and commentary on the battle over free trade, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.